Welcome to the Geriatric Journal Club, featuring practical discussions on the front line of PALTC issues that you wrestle with every day. This week's Geriatric Journal Club is a joint presentation of the Florida Journal Club and the Society for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care. References for this podcast and links to previous recordings can be found at paltc.org/journalclub. Support for this podcast is brought to you by U.S. Post-Acute Care.
So good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for joining the Florida Medical Directors Association and Society for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care Journal Club. This is our first Journal Club of the year, January 22nd, 2020. And we are going to dive in with a very robust topic on frailty. I think that, you know, in looking at this past year, we've seen multiple articles come through, both on the JAMDA side and JAGS and other geriatric publications on frailty. And we really wanted to just focus in on this and look at some articles that sort of represent the plethora, the multitude of articles that we were seeing coming through. So I wanted to just do a little flashback back to 2001 when we learned about frailty and really was introduced to this topic by Linda Freight, who defined the phenotype criteria for frailty. It then led to what has become a part of the foundational educational component, main educational component of geriatrics. It's a syndrome that I know we taught and I learned about in my geriatric fellowship and in the programs that I directed. It was a key component of our geriatric fellowship. And I think the same can be said for the geriatric education that we've seen across the country and the state over the past 20 years. So when we are thinking about how far and how long we've been talking about this, the most interesting thing to me is that we still haven't really determined how do we incorporate this into clinical practice. You know, we think about it every time we see a patient, whether it is in a clinical setting, a hospital setting, or in the nursing facility, you know, no matter where we're seeing it, I'm pretty sure that we could all attest to the fact that frailty is at something that comes to mind. We see our very vulnerable patients, especially in long-term care, who are often carted back and forth to the hospital, and we see their function declining, and it is something that we are addressing every day. But how do we really turn that into a practice? So the first article is a special article that was featured in JAMDA called Translating Frailty Research into Clinical Practice. And if you're not speaking, please put yourself on mute. This is insights from the Successful Aging and Frailty Evaluation Clinic. And what this looked at, the whole of this study was to really give a clinical perspective from a very successful clinic called the Successful Aging and Frailty Evaluation Clinic. What they did was they looked at different tools to identify and assess those patients who were referred to their clinic. So they included the phenotypic frailty criteria, but they also looked at some tools for activities of daily living, the vulnerable elder survey. They did a cognitive assessment, fall screening, and with a multidisciplinary interprofessional team that included a geriatrician, a geriatric trained nurse practitioner, social worker, medical assistants, and their staff, they conducted these evaluations. Their initial eval was 90 minutes. So that's what they would have them when that person came into their office. It would be a 90-minute visit initially, and then they would do subsequent 30-minute follow-ups. They created something which I applaud them on, where they call this the report card, where they looked at all of these tools and defined them as like the criteria between no or low risk, media risk, and high risk across the whole battery of the tools that they looked at. The A represents the numbers that they would score that patient on, and then B is the sample of how they would complete a card. So what we saw is that when we're looking, when they were doing this study, or when they've been doing this since 2011, they started this clinic. So over the past 7 years, they found that their top referrals came from for pre-procedural referrals, the need for co-management referrals, or symptom specific concerns like a fall or a decline in function, something around that. So for the pre-procedural referrals, their goal was to establish risk and inform eligibility, look at all the pre-surgical interventions that they needed to implement to either reduce frailty or reduce surgical risk, as well as prepare and prep for the post-operative care. So this is an example of the decision support tool that they use for geriatric surgical risk stratification. And what the most interesting comments that came out of this paper was really discussing how do we put this into action? How do we make this a part of the everyday clinical practice? They noticed that when they would receive referrals for co-management, you know, it was really about how do we document the degree of frailty, how do we identify and address any of the physical or social modifiers of frailty, what is the overall care plan need to look like, how do we treat the elements of frailty syndrome and implement advanced care planning. So that all goes into that first bullet here when with their recommendations to establish clear frailty clinical guidelines so that they can identify and treat the medical syndrome. And then we need to have more clarity about how we assess risk. As I said, they use the phenotypic frailty criteria, but as we move through some other papers, we're going to see that there are so many different tools. And, you know, we also need to make sure that when we're looking at this, how do we define the care plan for this syndrome? So there's just some framework that they offer to establish frailty clinical guidelines. And the takeaways I think that we need to consider is that there are multiple gaps that exist currently in our knowledge of and the science of frailty. So there's a lot of research that needs to be done in how we interpret some of those tools. What does it really mean to be frail? A lot of those issues, how do we define if there's a surgical risk based off of the frailty tool and which tool to use? So the challenges here are there's a significant amount of variability in screening tools and a significant amount of variability in clinical assessments. I'm sure if we all were having a patient go through a 90-minute assessment, it would be you'll gain a lot of knowledge and information about that patient's function and their overall status. But we know in the practical sense, we're usually not spending 90 minutes with one patient in practice. So how do we address the gaps in the knowledge and the inconsistency with assessments is a key takeaway that we need to consider. Which brings us to our next paper. So our next paper, I would call it a FRADA study, and I'm not sure if I'm saying the acronym right, but it's a new functional classification based on frailty and disability, and it stratifies the risk of mortality among older adults. So this study investigated a new classification that it combined the basic activities of daily living, instrumental activities of daily living, and frailty, and it associated it with the mortality of older adults. They looked at 924 participants aged 70 and older, and it was based in Spain. It had a cohort study with a 10-year follow-up. So they were able to get some useful and very interesting data out of it. And what they did was define 8 criteria by combining the basic activities of daily living, instrumental activities of daily living, and frailty. So as you can see at the top, we have a high functioning person. So they would be independent in all category. So for basic activities, daily living, toileting, grooming, those kind of things. For independent activities of daily living, which is your shopping, your managing your personal finance, frailty, you know, they would be classified as not frail. They also looked at the Barthel Index for, that is how they measure the basic activities of daily living, and they use the instrumental activities of daily living index for the IADLs and the frailty phenotype for defining frailty. So they on these categories, as you see, we move from high functioning all the way to severely impaired, which is the A and the lowest rung. So it's a very interesting and robust way of defining who is frail, who may be, as they classify, pre-frail versus frail and who is severely impaired. When they looked at the criteria, the characteristics, it matched up pretty well. Within this study, you know, it's important to note that 475 people died during the 10-year follow-up. We were able still to compare and collect their data. Mortality rates were higher toward the less functionally independent end of the functional continuum, which we would all probably hypothesize. When they looked at the Cox regression analysis, they ran two models. Model one adjusted for age and sex, and then model two included the Charlson comorbidity index that looked at institutionalization. The risk of mortality gradually increased toward the less functionally independent end of the functional continuum. So this is something that we, I guess, would all probably hypothesize as well, that we would see that those individuals who are severely impaired would have poor outcomes. Their conclusions is that new functional classification composed of basic ADLs, instrumental ADLs, and frailty is effective at stratifying risk for mortality in older adults. But what we, when, as you're reading through this page, this study and looking at it, there were a lot of difficulties and limitations. The one that the authors acknowledged was the difficulty in validating this outside of that population that they had in Spain, and the limitations around how they constructed the study. So there was, when they looked at these tools, when they defined the categories, when they looked at everything, it was based more on clinical experience and what they thought was probably the most the best way to categorize, to define a category, and less on any statistical analysis and population health study guidelines. So that's something to take into consideration, especially as we move into the third paper, which is predictive accuracy of frailty tools for adverse outcomes in a cohort of adults 80 years and older. And if you read through this study, you'll see that they refer to themselves as the Bell Frail study, because it was based in Belgium. And when you look at this cohort, it's really interesting the way that they decided to set up this study. So they looked, you know, and they acknowledged that there are a lot of frailty tools. Just in case anyone is curious, because I looked it up, it's about 67 frailty identification tools. I wanted to verify what the paper said. And there are a lot of different ways to look at frailty. So they took three different tools, as well as looking at activities of daily living. So the first tool, I'm going to probably butcher the name, but it's the Grogan-Ginn Frailty Indicator. The next one is the Cardiovascular Health Study Phenotype. And then the third one is the LASA, is the Longitudinal Aging Study Amsterdam. So then they, you know, they looked at this, they defined the studies, you know, it was significant outcomes included time to all-cause death, first unplanned hospitalization, and functional decline. When we looked at the characteristics of the population, it matched up pretty well. They also did assessments for many mental, depression screen, disease count, so how many other chronic conditions the person has. They looked at grip strength and walking time. So they included all of that as part of their study, when they divided out those individuals who met frailty by the cardiovascular health study phenotype versus the GFI versus the LAFA. So what they found, this is a Venn diagram that just demonstrates what they found. So of the 177 participants who were defined with frailty by any tool, so 177 of the participants had frailty by any tool. When they looked at the overlap of these tools, they saw that only 13% were frail by all three tools. And to give you a little bit more color around why that might be, the cardiovascular health study phenotype looks at weight loss, exhaustion, weakness, slowness, and low physical activity. So five components. The LAFA looks at 9 frailty markers. So low body mass index, low peak flow, low mini mental scores, urinary continence, poor vision or hearing, low mastery and resilience, which is my favorite, depression and low physical activity. The GFI looks at 15 different components. So 9 items that cover the physical self-reported limitations in physical domains, 1 item covering self-reported limitations in cognitive domains, 2 items covering psychological the psychological domain, and 3 covering social domain. So there's a huge amount of variability between those 3 tools. So it doesn't surprise me that we see that there's so little overlap in between the 3. When we look and then you break down each tool by itself, you see that, the darker line is representing those who are robust and healthy, while the dotted line are representing those who are frail. And for time to death and time to first hospitalization, as we move through the different tools, we see a similar pattern with all of these tools. And even when you say frail by any, so frail by any tool, you see a similar pattern. And that means that across all of those tools, we see that all-cause mortality and first hospitalization were higher for all participants identified with frailty. So then they looked at reclassification statistics, and what they found was that when you look at all these different things and we start to reclassify it, only the longitudinal study markers were significant for hospitalization and showed improvement. So not to even complicate it any further, but just to drive home the point, they did a decision curve analysis. So the decision curve analysis looked at, they added 2 standard measures, so treatment for all or treatment for none. And they looked at all of these studies and all of the tools and the measurements that they came. And what they found is that all the tools had a higher net benefit given the 2 default strategies. So the default strategy being treat all or treat none. They all had net benefits for mortality risk. They all had net benefits for risk for first hospitalization and probability of functional decline, but all the curves overlap for all relevant risks and thresholds. So we weren't able to really see that, like get a way to discriminate which may have been a better predictor, which may have been able to predict mortality, hospitalization, and functional decline better. And even though those frailty tools had clinical utility, it identified older adults with higher risk for adverse outcomes, they found that the predictive accuracy was very limiting. So, the key limitation and the significant takeaway from this was that those differences that exist between the many frailty tools, remember I said currently right now we have 67 that are available, it demonstrates that there is problems around consistency. So there are multiple inconsistencies between each of those tools. And that means that we're going to have problems when we're looking at reliability and validity of those tools.
The success of your practice depends on a support team that knows exactly how to navigate through the many variables and nuances of post-acute medicine. Based on years of practical clinical experience, the team at U.S. Post Acute Care is dedicated to enabling you to deliver the very best quality of patient care, providing a unique complement of administrative and clinical educational support services. To learn more about what U.S. Post Acute Care can do for your practice, visit uspostacutecare.com.
And just because it was getting really fun, I decided to throw it a little third article as I was doing some research around this topic, which is just a letter to the editor. And this is factors associated with improvement in frailty status defined using the frailty phenotype. This study was really looking at, do we see or are we addressing frailty as a dynamic continuum state that can improve and worsen? And the authors looked at a systematic review of the literature, went through about 60 studies or more, and 13 of those studies were identified. This is a list of the studies. They were looking at different things across the list of the study, but the goal was to find if they were looking for ways to improve frailty. And what they found was, they concluded frailty is a dynamic state. It is subject to improvement, but there is a significant lack of cohesion between frailty tools. And not all the studies adjusted for the same confounders of frailty. And so in order to make a better case, we need to better characterize the factors associated with frailty improvement. So this was just looking at frailty improvement and not mortality, but it's sort of the same issue because we do not have cohesion between the tools. So it's hard to say, how do I use this? And just think about, in our latest AMDA conference, we saw that there was a whole talk around frailty and using it to do risk for surgery, such as we saw that first study. But what is the impact of doing that when we don't have cohesion between what we're doing, like say here in Florida versus here in another state? So I wanted to open that up for discussion because, just to get any of your thoughts about what we saw and where we need to go when we're thinking about frailty as a syndrome and how to bring this into clinical practice. So now you can unmute yourself, and I welcome all and everyone to have an open dialogue.
Hi, Dr. Sanders. This is Dr. Novelli. Thank you so much for that excellent discussion. And I think you really bring out the issues with all of these frailty measurements. I think we're all looking for something that will translate into, give us a score or give us a measure and translate what we see with our eyes and see on exam into something more robustly actionable. Because I think we all recognize a patient who's frail. But we'd like to be able to catch them before they get that frail and see what we can do to alter trajectory and intervene. And that's the trick. We all recognize that very, very frail patient. But how about recognizing that frail patient a year before then and being able to intervene in a reproducible way? And I think that's what your review of these papers has really pointed out, that we're not there yet and we need to work to be there. And then we need to incorporate it into our practice.
So with that, I would like to thank everyone who's on the call and thank everyone who's going to listen to this later for your participation. Please feel free to send me any of your questions and any thoughts on what our next topics are going to be over the next 12 months. I'm really excited that we were able to start with something that, for lack of a better word, is like really intensely robust. And I just thank you for participating.
Support for this podcast is brought to you by U.S. Post Acute Care.